We are in Amos chapter 2. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Moab, yea, for four, I will not reverse it, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. So I will send a fire upon Moab, and shall devour the palaces of Kiroth. And Moab shall die with tumult, with shouting, and with the sound of the shofar. And I will cut off the judge from the midst thereof, and will slay all the princes thereof with him, says the Lord. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah, yea, for four, I will not reverse it, because they have rejected the law of the Lord, and have not kept his statutes, and their lies have caused them to err, after which their fathers did walk. So send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel, yea, for four, I will not reverse it, because they sell the righteous for silver, and the needy for a pair of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the humble. And a man and his father go unto the same maid to profane my holy name. And they lay themselves down beside every altar upon clothes taken in pledge. And the house of their God they drink the wine of them that have been fined. Yet destroyed I the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks. Yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. So I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up your sons for prophets, and your young men for Nazarites. Is it not even thus, O children of Israel? Says the Lord. But ye gave the Nazarites wine to drink, and commanded the prophets, saying, prophesy not. Behold, I will make it creak under you, as a cart creaks that is full of sheaves. And flight shall fail the swift, and the strong shall not exert his strength, neither shall the mighty deliver himself. Neither shall he stand that handles the bow, and he that is swift of foot shall not deliver himself. And it shall be that he that rides the horse deliver himself. And he that is courageous among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, says the Lord. That was Amos chapter 2. If you recall, we covered Amos chapter 1 2 weeks ago. And Amos chapter 1, we discussed all the various examples Amos was giving about the various nations from Edom and from, or all of them off the top of my head. There was Edom, there was Damascus, which is Syria, of course. There was Tyre, which is because the Phoenician area. Does anybody remember why Amos was going through these lists? What the purpose was? I tried to explain it to you 2 weeks ago. Why was he going through lists of these various nations? Of course, chapter 2 continues on with Moab and Judah. He was setting a stage for something, correct? He was setting an example, because he was giving examples of all these various countries, and his objective was that to point the people of Israel, by the way, he's speaking predominantly to the northern tribes, not to Judah, though he does address Judah occasionally. He was speaking to the children of Israel to realize that all these examples of all these nations are around you have done evil things. And here is one example of things they've done evil. And all of you would fully agree wholeheartedly, this nation, whichever nation he was talking about at that moment in time, deserved punishment. It was an easy slam dunk case. Of course Moab deserves punishment. Of course Edom does. Of course Sidon, which is a Tyre territory, which is a Phoenicia, does. Of course Syria does. It's obvious. And he was doing this in order to show them the example that just like you can easily see all these nations deserve great punishment for just the single item he listed, here's the massive list from Israel for you, for the northern tribes in particular. The point was, these are easy to call. These are easy for you to see. You should also easily see your own failures. That's the objective. So he's going through this list on purpose. His list of these other nations is not exhaustive. He cites one or two examples, and that's it. He doesn't continue on the entire litany of problems they have that Jeremiah talks about, that Isaiah talks about, when they address these same countries. They list a whole bunch of things they do. That was not Amos's objective. His objective is just say, hey, remember them? You get the idea? Now look at yourself. Amos's point was to look inward at Israel. He was not addressing the citizenry by themselves. Also thing to remember. If you notice, and I mentioned it last time, that all the corrections that Amos cites in each example, he addresses as what is the correction he gives? To burn the palaces of whatever the city, state that he happens to address. He always is phrased to burn the palaces of. That is not a correction on citizenry. That is a correction on leadership. The leadership is a failure point. That's Amos's point. The leadership has failed in their action or their deeds. And this is where his correction comes along. And of course, Jeremiah and Isaiah wholeheartedly back him up. They just do it in greater detail and more elaborate explanations is what Amos is talking about. As I'd also mentioned before, last time, with chapter 1, with regards to Edom and Edom's lack of forgiveness, who did Edom not forgive? Well, he did not forgive the actions of Moab and Judah, which, of course, Moab is listed, obviously, in chapter 2. The burning the king of Edom to lime, that, of course, is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 3 of what Moab did to the son of the king of Edom. Let's see here. Well, I already discussed at the time. It's the tale of chapter 3, verse 26-27. It discusses that Judah and Israel and Edom all gathered together to correct Moab's rebellion. They all came against Moab. They all destroyed and conquered and took these cities, after town after town after town. The king of Moab, at the last ditch effort, took, I think it was 700 of his men, and tried to penetrate deep into Edom's group of soldiers, failed, but pulled back. And in Moab's king's last ditch effort, says he took his son and burned him on the walls of the city. And of course, then it says great wrath was then put upon Judah. Now, if you read it in the English only, it sounds like Moab King Misha took his own son. But in the Hebrew, it does not specify whose son he was talking about. In the Hebrew, it talks about Moab or Misha, the king of Moab, was addressing Edom the whole time. So whose son was it? It was Edom's king's son. So the Edom's king's son, the son of the king of Edom, he was the one whom Moab burned to lime, so to speak. He's the one who burned him alive on the wall so everyone would see. And of course, in 2 Kings chapter 3, it also points out that great wrath was then put upon Judah and Israel by the hand of not Moab, because they're bottled up in a town. Well, who's going to put their wrath against Judah and Israel when it's not Moab? The only one left, called Edom. So Edom was infuriated with Judah and Israel for this onslaught against Moab that results in the death of Edom's son. That is the point of where this chapter comes from, and Amos is pointing this out to the issues of Moab. Now Moab also, of course, points out that in verse 2, he will die with great turmoil and shouting at the sound of the shofar. Moab, recorded in Jeremiah 48, discusses in great detail Moab's reputation is for brutality. That's what they do. They're good at it. They enjoy it. It's their expertise. They are known for mighty men of not valor, but of brutalness, of great strength and cunning to kill and be a backstabber, so to speak. They're good at that. More power to them, so to speak, if you wish to argue that. But unfortunately, that's the issue, that they will be death or killed in the same manner in which they kill. Which, of course, happens to Moab. And by the way, up until the time Moab is taken by Assyria, which happens a number of years later after this, after Amos is talking, Moab has known years and actually centuries of relative peace. They have dwelt in their own towns. They have dwelt in their own cities. No one has ever gotten rid of them, kicked them out, taken over them over. That hasn't really happened. Yes, they've been subjugated to Judah or to Israel at various times in their lives, but there was never an actual conquering completely. Even when Judah comes in and with Israel and Edom and destroys most of the town or countryside, except one city, Even then, they all leave, and Moab returns to its original towns and takes them all back and is independent. So Moab is known for having a type of security in their own territory. Jeremiah 48 tells them they will be completely extracted and nothing left of them to speak of. And if you look today, of course, Moab is an empty wasteland. No one lives there. There are some Bedouins. Okay, I'll give them that. They can have it. There's not much there. They can enjoy the one grass blade per 100 square miles that they can live off of. So that's the extent of Moab. Are there any questions regarding Moab before I move on to Judah and Israel? Okay. I know some of you are probably interested in what happens to Israel, which we'll get to shortly, because there's some interesting stuff Amos jumps into. Excuse me. Judah is addressed, of course, in verse 4 and onward, up through, of course, to through verse 5. What is Judah's transgression? What is his weakness? The laws of God. He rejected the laws of God, of course, following in the paths of his fathers. What laws is Amos addressing? Is he addressing the entire Torah? Like the priestly laws, this is clean, that's clean, don't touch this, do that. Is that those type of laws Amos addresses? No. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Not taking the father's support in the widow. That is true. That is one of the moral laws that Amos addresses. Anything else? Yes, Ellie.
That they got into Talmud instead of
Torah? No. Okay. That is, by the way, I mentioned when I talked about this 2 weeks ago, Amos's focus, his attention, is based on social injustice. That's his focus. It's not the only thing that Israel and Judah does wrong. It's social injustice is the symptom that he addresses over and over and over again. What was it again? From the palace. It's from the ruling class. It's a social injustice from the ruling class. It's not just from one person to the other person. It's a social injustice he's focusing on. Yes, Anne.
All right. Well, it says they perverted the way of the humble, but I also say perversion and incest.
We're going to address the incest shortly. There's an interesting thing going on there, which we'll talk about. That's in verse 7. This is where that, however, is specifically to Israel. In verse 4 and 5, he focuses dominantly on Judah. Isaiah chapter 5 addresses in much greater detail the social injustice that Judah was doing or practicing at the time of Amos. Because Isaiah and Amos are not quite contemporaries. Isaiah is a number of years younger and shows up on the scene at the tail end of Amos's speaking. But they still are talking about the same topics. So I want you to go to Isaiah chapter 5. We're not going to read the entire chapter just yet. We'll read a section of it. This is an example of the social injustice that Amos rails against Israel in the balance of this chapter as well as future chapters of Amos. But this is addressed specifically by Isaiah to the house of Judah. We're not going to read the entire chapter right now. We're going to jump straight to one example, which is verse 8. Because this verse 8 is brought up against Israel later on in the book of Amos. Verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 5. Woe to you who cause the house to encroach against house and make field approach field until there is no more place. Are you the only ones to be settled in the midst of the land? It has entered to my ears, says the Lord, Master of Legions. I swear that many houses and great and splendid ones will be laid ruin without inhabitant. For 10 portions of a vineyard will produce only one bath, and an omer of seeds will produce only one ephah. That section is critical to most of the book of Amos. What that section, does anybody realize what that section is saying? It's saying, I'll leave this part of it up. I'll stay over here. So, field to field and house to house. You are accumulating fields to field and houses to houses. There's a law about that. The Torah law about that. Do you remember what the law is regarding accumulating houses? And you, by the way, this is permanent ownership. Not supposed to be. Permanent ownership. You are accumulation. of houses and fields by a specific ruling class. That is one of the examples given. This is a social injustice that is given in Isaiah chapter 5 that Amos then levels against Israel 150 years, well, not before they get this, before Judah gets punished for it. But they level against Israel before Isaiah levels it against, more specifically against Judah. So, and this is not the only one listed, of course. There's also others that in Isaiah chapter 5, which we're going to get to shortly in a few minutes from now. Well, what does that mean? To accumulate your houses and fields and join them together that you are the only inhabitant of the land. Yes, Ellie.
Wouldn't that mean because you're rich, you have all kinds of property and you have all kinds of real estate and you buy it all up and the farming is a problem because
it's all yours.
Because there's not, people don't have a farm or a place to live.
Right. Basically, you are evicting the current ownership or subjugating them to pay you rent in order to work your land for you. It was your land, but now it becomes to the owner's land. That is one example of the fields to field. Yes.
So they were not returning the land at the end of the Jubilee.
Correct.
Or at the Jubilee.
That Isaiah points, I forgot what chapter it is, he points that out later on about Judah that doesn't do that. They're supposed to be. And by the way, this, everything that you see in Isaiah chapter 5, you can literally replace the word Judah with Israel. And it still equally applies. It's just that it applies many years later on Judah versus on Israel is being applied now in this modern time of Amos. Isaiah's examples are also true, and they were true at Isaiah's time, but God does not punish Judah until 150-ish years later after he takes care of Israel. It is a warning to Judah ahead of time that this is what you're doing, and Amos is pointing out this is what Israel has been doing. Yes, Ellie.
Well, also, if you bring it up to modern day, Judah doesn't have as much land to to spread out and steal everything, and Israel is huge, and they still, the rich people, take all of the
The example, of course, is a social injustice example, which is still alive and well today. Now, this is specifically not about a rich individual. This is about a ruling class of group of people. It is not about Joe Schmuck. Well, I'll call him Bob Schmuck, because Joe's just Lutheran. Yeah, thank you. Bob Schmuck over here, he may have lots of money. And if somebody over here is selling, so he buys it, that's his business. That is Bob Schmuck's business. Now, ruler, a little name, Daniel Schmuck, over on this side, says, you know what? I can get a whole lot more money if I take your land and have it rezoned for development. That's what we see today. That is called a ruling class making a decision or acquiring a piece of property, whether they pay full price or however the government does make a difference. It's a ruling class's decision to do something. That's the example. This is a ruling class. Now, in Amos, as in chapter 3 and 4 and 5, it addresses the methodology which the ruling class chose to do their acquiring of land and houses. But we'll get there shortly. So those are the examples of social injustice we're discussing. And the laws that Judah is being addressed in verse 4, they're failing, has very little to do with the priestly conduct. Amos is addressing the social injustice laws that Judah failed in verse 4. The social injustice laws specifically, which has huge ramifications today in the Shemitah year and the Shemitah cycle that Jonathan Kahn pointed out that we're going through. The social injustice laws are essentially like the tipping point, the last straw of God. You've failed to do many things, but once you've got the social injustice of how you treat poor, how you treat those who are purposely oppressing them, that's when God says, okay, I'm done. And this is where Amos is coming from. God is literally telling Israel, I'm done. So we move on from Judah after their desires of personal gain and addresses into Israel, which is more detailed. Verse 6, Now, this is a very unique poetic wording. I do not want to go too deep into its explicit examples, but selling the righteous for silver, what does that mean? Any ideas? This is Amos chapter, still chapter 2. Sorry, we're moving on to verse 6 of Amos chapter 2. It says, I will not revisit because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes. Now, this is not necessarily what it appears to say on the surface. Amos is making a poetic addressing. Yes, Ellie.
Making it illegal that churches can't meet in schools.
Okay, would have gotten there. Could be. That could be an example. I won't argue that one. I don't know.
In other states, they can. In California, they cannot. And you make money off of it, but you deliberately undercut churches.
Sorry, that was... agreed, that is a type of social injustice. I will grant that. That is true. I hadn't thought about applying that to this verse. But one could argue that. I could see that. Yes, Carrie.
It just made me think of Judas Iscariot with Messiah.
Right. Selling a pair of righteous for silver. And the needy for a pair of shoes. Yes, Anne.
Well, maybe making them bondage servants, making them work hard, laboring.
It is. I'm going to try to word this a little differently. Now, don't get wrong, my wording... Oh, sorry, go ahead. Sean, you had a question?
First thing that popped in my mind here about the shoes.
Right.
What was the promise with the Israels everywhere they put their feet? Right? So if they're selling their birthright with the silver, I see the connection.
There is it is a monetary transaction, you're right. This is what's being sold, but we're going to address that element of it, the shoes, and how it connects to the silver in a moment. Because that's part of it. You all have touched on the elements. But what I'm going to direct this just a little bit, in my own view, how I see it, is that, first of all, this is a poetic example. Poem means, it doesn't mean necessarily what it specifically says, as opposed to it addresses something that is happening as a general concept. So when you sell someone who is righteous for silver, you are selling, in one way you could argue they're selling them as a slave, but it is a type of servitude. It's servitude. It is a type of indentured servant. You are making the person to be righteous, you must pay in existence to be righteous. That is one example that Israel does. But more importantly, since he amends that same statement, it says, and the needy for a pair of shoes. Does anyone recall the example given with Boaz and what happened with Ruth? Yeah, yes. Jeff?
Well, I mean, the parallel structure of this would then make the connection here of you're selling the poor for, you know, the price of a pair of shoes, righteous for silver, meaning that you are undervaluing the righteous.
That
you're
is
selling
true.
Them for far below what
you
their
are.
Worth is. Just
yes.
Like you're oppressing the poor for like the value of a pair of shoes.
Exactly. It is a great undervalue. It is a combination of the two. The righteous and the needy are the same person or same type of person in this group, in this example. So a righteous for silver or a needy for silver makes no difference. A righteous for a pair of shoes and a needy for a pair of shoes makes no difference. The point is, you're selling someone who is righteous or needy for something that is of low value. Now, this is the key point, though. It's the shoes. It's the shoes. The service, the shoes. What is the shoe mean?
Take care of.
It can mean that. Obligation to take care of is a permanent transaction. Yes, Deanne.
Well, I was thinking shoe is the word going out too, isn't it?
Not in this application. Not in this application. Yes, if somebody was sent on a journey to shoe to go do something, or dust in your shoes, you're going somewhere, that would be application for sending out information or sending an assignment. But this is a transaction occurring between shoes. Yes, Anne.
Does it have something to do with, like, with Ruth,
yes.
You know, her brother-in-law, or the one who was supposed to take over?
The kinsman to redeem
Ruth. And he was to take the shoe and throw it. You know,
right.
And then maybe declare something about his brother that he was not going to take care of this issue. And then Boaz would be able to meet the obligation.
Permanent. Anyway. a shoe, you exchange shoes, and the case with Boaz, which is a perfect example of it. It is a poetic transaction. It's a reference to a permanent exchange, which means those who are needy, those who are righteous, you are selling for silver permanently. As in, is there ever freedom? No. Is there ever release? No. Is there even a reasonable value given? No. It's cheap. And what is the objective for doing that? Well, it's given in verse 7. You pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor. What does that mean? What is that trying to tell you? They are acquiring in Isaiah 5, which Judah was assigned as the examples. By the way, I mentioned before, Isaiah 5 can be applied to Judah or Israel. They both did the exact same thing. They're mirror images of each other. Isaiah 5 points out that you accumulate houses, you accumulate fields where you're the only one settled. Israel did the exact same thing. There's no difference. The point is, however, here in examples, even after you've done so, you are still desiring or panting at the dust that's still on the head of the poor person. You still have a little dust. I want that too. It is evil. It is an evil application. It's a social injustice example. Now, of course, it continues on so in verse 7. So it's a service or an exchange of value of righteous to silver, which Jeff correctly pointed out is a gross devaluation. Which is more valuable to you? A righteous person, which means, by the way, a righteous person means they are obeying laws, they are being kind to another, they are generous, they are doing as best they can, not causing harm to other people, trying to spread what is good and what is fair and just, teach the children what is righteous, to build a good, clean, well-founded society. That's what a righteous person does. Instead of having those things, they'd rather have silver. It is a gross devaluation.
So that's like
major. It is a selling out. It is greed. It's selling out of a society, of a base, which is social injustice. To sell out the base of your society, what your society stands on is the base. You are exchanging that for silver. Now, this is a, as the shoes point out, a permanent transaction. It's not temporary, it's forever. You don't want that society to exist. You don't want that part of your society. You'd rather have the silver, and it is of, those individuals are of no value to you. Yes.
What's going on today?
Yes, in many ways it is, in different aspects, because there's lots of social injustices pervasive in all societies, and it's just all we see as those who are not in the ruling class. We see these social injustices more prominently than those who are in a ruling class. Amos addresses ruling classes specifically. It does depend where you are, because some people can see them when they're in the ruling class, they choose not to. It's a blind by decision, not a blind by have to. Any questions so far? Because we're going to go into a more delicate topic. Yes, go ahead.
Communism. Communism, it's putting the people down for the sake of power, greed of the people in control, blah, blah, blah.
To me, that is the nature of all government in general. All government uses the population base to establish its power. Whether it chooses to use it as a great oppression or great support, it's still the government is propped up by a people base. Communism does it in a particular method. Socialism is a different method. Fascism is a different method. A capitalism is a different method. They all have different methods, but they all accomplish the same effect, which is the ruling class dictates what everybody else does, right or wrong. And they just discard what is of no value to the ruling class. And a righteous person isn't any value to a ruling class. Why is it not value? Because they do not bring in or produce any more money than an unrighteous person does. They're the same. So a ruling class is going to value a monetary gain. gain of territory, gain of property, gain of power, gain of money, whatever it is. That's what a ruling class does. That's what governments do. That's their job. Here, notice that. To gain power, to gain influence. That's what they do. So however they choose to do it, that's the method they chose. But it's still a ruling class process. And that's their responsibility to see their injustice, what they're applying to the people. So Amos is very strong against this. He is not a socialist. He's just pointing out what society has done in the ruling class against the rest of the individuals. And this part, which you're going to the second half of verse 7, is... Right. This is a more delicate topic, because I see it a particular way, and some of you may disagree with me, and that's fine. But this is how I see it. I'm going to express how I see it. The second half of verse 7 of chapter 2, it says... And a man and his father go unto the same maid to profane my holy name. On the surface, you already know that there's Asherah worship that happened, that was going on in Amos' time, which is a sexual worship of God. Now, Asherah was called by northern Israel, not the Judah necessarily, but northern Israel in particular, the wife of God. Now, we would use the word God as in God the Creator. Now, he has no wife, obviously. But in their pagan influences, when they blended Asherah and Baal together, and they used Asherah and Baal and the sun god that comes out of the two of them, that Baal was wiped out, so they still had Asherah left, and they still had the original calves built by Jeroboam the First, and said, hey, Israel, these calves are your real god, and they used God's name, he used God's name as the identifier of these two calves. He named them that name. So Israel just mixed everything up and said, oh, okay, well, we still have Asherah. Baal's gone. Asherah, and she has to be the mother of something. And, oh, hey, look, there's a god. There you go. They married him together, and now the king is supposed to be supposedly the son. Or it's a type of rulership or king worship. It's the same process. But in the nature in which this is done, there are Asherah female servants. Their job, or priestesses, or priests, you would call them, their job is to be physically available to any male who wishes to worship that Asherah in that physical application. That's how the surface application, how it surface what it appears to say. But remember, Amos is talking about a social injustice. So that, although it is explicitly forbidden for a man and his father to go in the same wife in the Torah, it's explicitly forbidden to do so. There's something else going on here. Because it says in the last of the verse, to profane my holy name, means that's the objective. Not the people's objective, it's not the father's objective, not the man's objective, not even the woman's objective. It's not to profane God's name. Their objective is to worship. That's the way they wish to worship. I'm going to say something up here, and you may disagree with me, but this is what I'm going to say anyway. There is a technique or a style of which this does. The process of which their sexual encounter is happening is a way of legitimizing, I'm going to abbreviate, legitimizing a worship or a celebration of God, worship, through a sexual deviancy. I'm going to abbreviate again. I never spell it right. In other words, you can use the same statement, the same concept, as you're taking God's name and giving his name as if he has approval over this process of worshiping him. Because it's legitimizing it. It's taking God's name and saying, I'm going to put his stamp, his name, on my encounters, and thus legitimize the process. That has implications today. Yes, Cheryl? It does sound like Easter. That is still commonly done. But something's going to happen this June, which we'll see what happens in June. There's another way of doing this. I'm going to do this on purpose, but you don't have to agree or not. You know what that is? It's the same process, because homosexual marriage is the exact same thing. They are taking a union God designed, God set it up, and taking his name by putting a marriage behind it and requiring people to accept it, making it, this is an acceptable behavior, an acceptable celebration of God, or acceptable because it's love. It's legitimate, whatever we're going to argue it. It's not that this is what's happening with the man and woman, man, son, father, and his, and the woman they're going into. It's the concept of taking a sexual deviancy and putting God's name on it, saying, see, it's good. It's okay. He approves. It's that process. It's that idea behind it. Because God's love. He's love. Now, I'm not saying that Amos is addressing homosexual marriage. He's not. He's addressing a man and his father going to the same woman. But it says to profane God's holy name, which, of course, homosexual marriage would do so. It would profane God's holy name by doing so. So this is my opinion. You can reject as you wish, but it's my opinion only. I'm going to erase it now, but that's what stuck on me today when I read that. Well, last night, we were discussing right in my notes cell last night about this, and it's like, wow, that still looks awfully similar to what I see today. Okay, now let's move on. That was strictly my opinion. You may disagree, that's okay. Verse 8. They lie themselves down by the altar, beside every altar, upon clothes taken in pledge. What does that mean? And recall Exodus chapter 22. There are rules about taking things in pledge. Specifically, tail end of 22 of Exodus, verse 26, 27. It says, when you take a pledge of the poor person, the poor man, poor woman, because they owe you something. And if the pledge is their garment or their clothing, typically what it winds up being, you must return that by the end of the day. Because he has nothing to clothe himself. He's naked, or she's naked. He's naked. He has no clothing. That's what the instruction was. Now, of course, in this example, it cites that what is the ruling class actually doing? Well, they're keeping it. They keep it. Well, mind you, these people who are panting at the dust on the head of the poor. Not only have they taken your land and your house, I want the dust on your head too. They're already after everything. So you take a pledge, you're not going to give it back. Of course not. It's yours now, because you're now the ruling class. You have the decision to make, process to do so. So the process, the same thing is happening. Of course, they in the house of their God, they drink, in the latter half of verse 8, they drink the wine of them that have been fined. So they're taking the fines off these poor people. By the way, they're perverting the way of the humble as well. Take the fines of the poor people, buying wine or buying goods or things that they wish to celebrate with. I'm sure you see headlines probably every other week about some corrupt federal doing something, spending excess money on this, you know, illegal activity or that. I think it happened actually just 3 days ago. it's pretty frequent. It's taking funds from those who don't have much and use them in a very corrupt method to further gain your own belief or your own power in your worship of your God. These social injustices are continuing on in Amos. Until verse 9, when God finally stops the socialists and reminds them who he is, who he was. It says, yet I, God, he destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was great, the cedars and the oaks, and yet he destroyed their fruit from above and the roots from beneath. By the way, that means he took the blossoms off the fruit from above. It means take the blossoms off your tree and get knocked down to the ground. That's what it means. And the roots beneath is to rot the root out. That is explicitly explained to us. Actually, that exact example is told to explain what he's doing with that roots above. Is in Isaiah 5 also in verse 24. It addresses specifically that God's what God was doing. That to destroy the fruit above, taking the blossom, you have no ability to produce anything. You have no value. So God took the Amorite and he destroyed them from above and from below. And took everything from them in order to give it to Israel. And yet, what have they done? He brought them out of Egypt for 40 years, possessed the land. He even, verse 11, raised your sons for prophets and your young for Nazarites. You know it is true in verse 11. And of course, verse 12 points out, what'd you do? You made the Nazarites drink wine. You made the prophets say, prophesy not. You see, making somebody who is trying to do righteously, trying to do good, and putting sin in them by coaxing them or teaching them or leading them towards sin is a greater sin in God's eyes than you yourself doing the sin. leading someone else to sin is far worse than sinning yourself. Anyone recall Eli and his sons? They were sinners, but leading Israel to sin, God was so infuriated, he not only wiped out Eli's entire future line. What's the word? Opposite of ancestor, it's the progeny. Wiped all his progeny out forever. Wiped them out. Even though they weren't even born yet. Wiped them out anyway. Yes.
So Eli, because he wasn't correcting his sons, lost his whole generation.
His whole line from that point forward was all wiped out. I shouldn't say from that point forward. It took a few years, but eventually, a few generations, they were just oppressed. And by the time Solomon showed up, they were dead.
It's not so much that I'm looking at Samuel right now. His sons did evil too.
Yes, they did.
But he talked with them, corrected them.
Correct.
But it stands in the hands of the sons. In the case with Eli, no.
He didn't do anything.
He didn't.
Right. And God pointed out for Eli and his sons, he made Israel sin and profaned God's name in the process. Because then people associate God's name with what happens in the temple, and look what happened in the temple. Ew. You associate God's name with something that is profane, disgusting, with what his sons were doing. Eli, of course, refused to do anything to fix it or stop it. And so you're forcing or putting sin upon somebody else who is trying not to do so. That is a greater sin than anything else. Now, In verse 13, this is where God discusses the punishment. And again, Amos uses a very poetic way of describing it. And if he says, "Behold, I will make it creak under you as a cart creaks that is full of sheaves." Now, what does that mean? Ground shaking. Not an earthquake. It's a ground shake. Yes.
But just back to what you're noting about leading people astray, one of the common things that I hear from people is to, why they walked away from God was because they went to a local congregation and people weren't acting godly, so they left.
Yeah, that does happen. It's the same principle, the same process. If they go to a place of worship, they expect a certain behavior, and your behavior is heavily deviant. There is no God there. Now, and Amos was very careful in how he describes in chapter, I think it's chapter 4 or chapter 5, I can't remember off the top of my head. One second. In chapter 5, he talks about that northern Israel is not anti-religious. They have no God, but they have an abundance of religion still. Okay? Amos makes a point to note that. They have lots and lots of religion on it. An abundance of it, excessive amounts, lots of forms, all at the same time. But there's no God in it, because the religion doesn't give you God. The religion gives you religion. God gives you what is good. And Amos makes a point to say to explain that to northern Israel. That's what they're doing. They still have the appearance, the outside surface of lots and lots of belief in whatever deity you can think of, and all worshiping every form you can possibly imagine. But there is no God in it. Which, if you go to, as Jeff correctly pointed out, a particular synagogue or group or church or whatever, and the deviant behavior is so prevalent, they have lots and lots of religion, belief, love God, God loves you, God is love, blah, blah, blah. But God isn't there. Meaning God's not actually in it, per se. You understand what I mean? Hopefully you understand the concept which I'm trying to convey. So, go back to verse 8. The ground shake. What specifically is he talking about? No, not an earthquake. Not an earthquake. You could argue that, but that's not what it is. Yeah, I thought that. It's not an earthquake. Some have thought that this was Amos's warning to say, hey, you're going to an exile. No. An exile. This is verse 13. To make it creak under you as a cart creaks is full of sheaves. What makes ground shakes that aren't earthquakes? So a lot of things going too fast and heavy. What does really fast and really heavy? Armies do. Now, Northern Israel is about to be completely wiped out by the Assyrian army. And they're going to take everything. Leave virtually no one of any value left. And they're going to replace those people with people who have no comprehension of God at all. It's literally like a transplant, so to speak. They're translated. That's the type of ground shaking that Israel is going to experience. And Amos is alluding to that. The ground's going to shake under you. Because you have no foundation. You have nothing that is strong. You're on a cart that is creaking. Does a cart have any foundation? Of course not. It's on wheels. That's not a foundation. It's purpose is designed not to be stable. It's designed to move. It's on wheels. So he's going to make their foundation crumble or crack or tremble. What is their foundation supposed to be? It's supposed to be based on God. Well, God's long gone from northern Israel. He's not even there anymore, other than he gets a few snippets here and there from a prophet to go give a message, but he's not worshipped, he's not honored, there's nothing really there. So, that's what's going to happen to them. Their army, or an army, is going to take out their foundation. And of course, in the rest of the balance of the chapter, he discusses all the various types of people, from those who are fast, those who are strong, those who has the bow, who has the horse, makes a difference, no one escapes. What message, what's that final say, what does it finally tell Israel, Northern Israel in particular?
It does mean to wake up.
That's true. It does. That's the general theme, is to be wake up, pay attention, see what's happening. And this is what's going to happen to you. That's true in general for Amos as a whole. In this particular section, he's pointing out that, to me at least, when I see all this chapter discusses the social injustice of those who are the ruling class, who is the ruling class? By the way, what do they rule? They rule the people, and what is their arm of strength? A military is your arm of strength, is it not? What makes a ruling class those who can rule over you? Well, they have a physical arm that can crush you. That's called, they rule over you. They have a military, they have police, well, they have police, the military in particular, and they have guards, they're former police. In order to do things. And what does it say specifically about all these various groups of people? Those who are fast, military is usually fast, and the strong shall not exert the strength. They will not be strong enough. You will not be fast enough. Your might, your military strength will not deliver even the individual. Even the individual man or woman or child, not a child, but individual person, you are not, individually you cannot escape. You cannot sneak away. You cannot run fast enough. You cannot fight your way through. You cannot flee. Nothing you can do about it. You're done. What are you talking about? Calvinism, huh? Your fate has been sealed. So that's the balance of the chapter, of course, discusses that. Those who are courageous, you will have no courage. You'll flee away naked in that day, which is what happens to a large percentage of northern Israel. They're carried away captive. Armies wiped out. Nobody really left to even speak of. And they're carried away with literally the clothing on their back. In some cases, no clothing on their back. There's not much left. And they're carried away. All because of what? They rebelled against God. And it's a basic form of rebellion. A basic form in that because Amos and Isaiah and Jeremiah say the same thing about Israel and Judah respectively, it's how they treated the poor and the fatherless, and the needy, and the widow. It's how they treated those individuals that finally God snapped. I'm done. The group, that class of people, is very critical to him. Because who is the father of the fatherless? God is. Who is the husband of the widow? Right. Who is the friend of the stranger? Yeah, get the theme? They are addressing, they are oppressing these people who he himself said he is responsible for. It's no different than you as a parent having little children and something comes and attacks your children. Or attacks your wife, if you're a husband. You are the one responsible for them. Your wrath, your anger toward that attacker will be great. Because you are responsible. These are gifts that God gave to you to take care of. And they're being destroyed before your eyes. Isaiah is very, very clear in, I think it's chapter 10 or chapter 11. I think it's chapter 10. He says, woe to those who make laws that oppress the poor of my people. That is the ultimate snapping point for God. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so, but in our government, you know, we have politicians and the government itself wanting to just give money to the poor and give money to the widows and orphans, if you want to say, but giving money and just providing welfare to them doesn't really make them, doesn't really meet the social justice that you're talking about. And they'll use the word social justice in all the news and everything like that, as if it's the politicians who can give them money to make up for the social injustice that they have to go through.
Right. See, that's cheating. That's actually a debasing of those people, those needy individuals. If I say, hey, you know what? I'm going to steal all your stuff, oppress you. Oh, here's $20. Oh, I'll take care of you from now on. That is actually a form of thievery. Yes.
And to kind of elaborate on that a little bit more, the government, when they say, oh, we're going to use your money to take care of the poor are the excuse to take care of themselves. If they take a dollar out of your wallet, they don't turn around and give that $1 to the poor. They take 75 cents for themselves and maybe give 25 cents to the poor.
Right, right. That is true. It is a complete missing of the purpose in general. So I'm not railing against, you know, welfare, trying to help people out from the government standpoint. I don't really care. That's their business. That's their business transactions, what they wish to do. That's how they do things. And that doesn't matter. The point is, the social injustice is to make it a scenario or a situation in such a way that those who are needy, those who are poor, those who are fatherless, the widow, blah, 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 they are in a state of being they cannot get out of. That is your key element. Because if you make it where a state of being gets you out of it easily, as God's laws do, you have made it an equal playing field. You made it I forget the right word. It's like egalitarian, I think is the right word. To where everybody is pretty much the same. No matter who you are, how much money you've got, you're pretty much the same. You have the same laws, same methods of getting out, and you choose to do so or choose not to. It's your business. When you make a scenario which it doesn't work that way, and it cannot work that way, the individual's not able to get back up, you have made an oppressive situation. Not by a single law, not by a single action, but by many of them all combined together. Because in my personal opinion, gifting money to someone who is poor is not necessarily evil. Quite the opposite, that's fine. But get them in such a way to where it incentivizes that individual or the society around to maintain that poor is a social injustice. The person doesn't have the option of getting back out again. Some do. Some still struggle through and they make their way out. Don't get wrong. God bless every one of them. But some don't. And it's the law cycle. And Amos is focusing on the social injustice of what the ruling class has done to oppress those who are the poorer class by taking what is rightfully theirs. But still, quote, providing for them, end of quote, giving them enough to survive on. Not much. Make sense? Any other questions or comments? That's Amos chapter 2. He goes into great detail in 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and continue on and how it's going to happen and how he plays out every detail, which we'll have fun with talking about that when we get there.